Session number 17183, Reel 1, followed after a pause by Reel 2, Roman Halter. The left channel is informants mic only, right channel both microphones.
Roman Halter, Reel 1. So if I could ask you then, Roman, first of all, something about your background before the war. What are your memories of your early life and your parents?
Well, firstly, my name is Roman Halter. I was born 7th July 1927 in a town called Chodecz. Chodecz was 30 kilometers away from Włocławek. Włocławek was on the Wisła. And if one looks at the pre-war, pre-Second World War map of Poland, one can see the Wisła winding towards Gdynia and Gdańsk, towards the Baltic. And I lived on the west side of the Wisła, somewhere between, halfway between Warsaw and Torun. Chodecz was classified by some as a large village or a tiny little town. In Yiddish, people would call it a shtetl. And the Jewish community there in the 30 census was over 700. Martin Gilbert, Sir Martin Gilbert now, calculated by 39 there were about 800 Jews who lived there. Roughly, there were the same number of Germans as Jews, and about twice as many Poles. So really, if one puts it correctly, there were Polish Jews, Polish Germans, and Polish Christians. Polish Germans were Protestants, were Jews, and there were no divisions between the Jews in a way that communities are divided here between Reform, United, very Orthodox, semi-Orthodox. There was one rabbi who was a community leader, and he was fully, with his committee, in charge of the spiritual Jewish life of the town. In fact, it was a tradition then that the community did not spare money in order to get the best community leader, best rabbi. And we had a rabbi who was a learned and wise man, because he also adjudicated about certain differences between families. Jewish people in our town did not go to court, to law. They appealed to the rabbi, and he chaired this sort of din in order to assess whether party A is right or party B is right. And all this worked very well. He also decided on the schooling, and we children in Chodecz, Polish Jewish children, had to go before Polish school very early in the morning for lessons. And then come quickly home and then go to Szkoła Powszechna, because it became compulsory for everybody to attend the school, which was called the Szkoła Powszechna. When I was born, I was given the name Ruven, but we had to Polishize, culturalize our names. So when we entered the school, the teacher decided of what name every Jewish child should have. And Reuven became Roman, Moshe became Monik, and so it went on. The same applied to the girls. And my parents felt, not to confuse me too much, they accepted this word Roman, and I became Roman, and diminutive name for me when I was very good, which was not so often, I became Romek. Now, but this was accepted by my family, by the rabbi, by other people. But when we were called in synagogue before the Torah, we were called by the name Reuven, and that was accepted too.
How do you spell that?
Reuben? Well, you could spell R-U-B-E-N, Reuben, or Reuven, R-E-U-V-E-N. It's a biblical Hebrew name, and most Jews had Hebrew biblical name. So, in fact, the name Halter was a 19th century invention. Before it was, once my father was Mordechai, he would be called Mordechai ben Moses, the son of Moses. Now, we Halters, who lived in Poland for quite a long time, were given the name. Either you went along with the name, or you asked the people who registered to give you a name. And there was quite a lot of humor about it, because the man who registered decided that he will give everybody a sort of a name with the root of, say, Rose. So it was Rosen, Rosenblatt, Rosenkopf, Rosen that. So you find these names sort of were invented out of a hat. Now, my family, who were fairly literary, had one member in the family who was the rabbi of Ger, and he's quite famous. And even the disciples now at Jerusalem, Yad Vashem, still worship the Ger rabbi, and there are various descendants. And his name was Ha Alter, the old one, from Hebrew. Now, my father used to go once a year with presents to him, because he was a cousin. I don't know if he was a cousin twice removed. And he found that particular rabbi of Ger extremely knowledgeable and wise. He knew quite a lot about medicine. He was very well read. And my father came home one day and he said, my elbow is cured. He went along to him, and he had a very stiff elbow. Most people today would have a cortisone injection. It's like a tennis elbow, and it worried him greatly. But his cousin said to him, what you have to do is warm oil, massage it in, then put rags around it and leather binding loosely, and keep it overnight, and keep it also warm the next day. And then it went, and it was a simple solution. But my father was invigorated. He was inspired by these meetings with him. And I, as a child, who sat at the luncheon table with my ears absolutely pricked to every word that was said, liked to listen to all these conversations. Now, the Halters really split up into different names. For instance, some of them became lawyers, unqualified lawyers, because they read a lot and they wrote and they knew Russian, German, Yiddish, Polish. And the population, Polish population, the villagers, were totally illiterate. And so they had little sort of, not offices, tiny corners of the room where the Poles used to come with 3-4 eggs and say, sir, could you write me a letter? And this letter was written. And they became Halterrecht. Recht was like a lawyer's office. And some of them became Federhalters, scribes, because they were scribes for the Torah. So really this artistic streak of doing calligraphy and Torah writing was inherited, I think, by my family, like music is inherited from one family to another. And that continues really now in the children. And I also find that this creative work inspires me and interests me. Now, the community of 800 people there consisted of poor and very poor people. I thought we were very well off, and we belonged to the sort of 3-4 families who were considered rich, because my father was a timber merchant. And he also dealt in coal and building materials. And his father, my grandfather, lived in Izbica Kujavska, which was 16 kilometers away. And my father and his brother were very close together. And my uncle, my father's brother, who was in Izbica Kujavska, who took over the sawmill from my grandfather, had children with the same names as my father. And so my eldest brother was Shlomo, Shlamek, and my uncle also had the eldest son called Shlomo, Shlamek, and so on it went down. So this went down right along the line of the family. Unfortunately, with the depression in 1929, my family suffered a further setback that some competitor set our place on fire, and many things were burned. And certain dealings which my father had with his brother, and they owned land together, soured the relationship within the family, between the family in Izbica Kujavska and my father. Because my father found after the fire that he had to rebuild himself, and he went to his brother and said, we must sell the land because I need the money. And it wasn't time to sell the land, and the brother said, no, not really, you should wait. My mother kept out of it, but my father was a very impetuous man, and he insisted. And so when the land was sold, they hardly spoke to one another. And then 1 year later, my uncle died, and his eldest son took over the business, and my grandfather died there. So I was not allowed to go to Izbica Kujavska to meet my cousins. Occasionally, one of the cousins came over to us, but he came over simply to negotiate what is going to happen about certain lands which they own jointly. As a child, I learned about it. I had to accept. Now, in retrospect, I felt what a pity that it was so. Because all the people from Izbica Kujavska were the first one to be sent to Chełmno extermination camp. And the equivalent to me, the youngest one, was Moniek, not Roman. And Martin Gilbert describes in this chapter 16 about Holocaust survivor, and he mentioned Moniek there before when the extermination started in Chełmno. Now, coming back to Chodecz, our synagogue was built on the way down towards the lake, and it was a wooden structure. And to us children, it was a beautiful structure because it was like a musical instrument inside. You felt that you sat inside a violin and prayed. And the cantor, who was also the shochet was the slaughterer for ritual killing. He had a beautiful voice, and in order to earn enough money to bring up his family, he had to perform two functions. He acted as the shochet plus the cantor, and his children sang beautifully, and they were in the choir. And I remember I always wanted to be in the choir, and I went for an audition to him. And he said, well, not this year, but come next year, and perhaps you get into the choir. So I went next year because I was a keen young boy. And he said, a great improvement, but I think really that you should only sing for the family. You are not yet fit to sing for the choir. I was terribly downhearted by this. And the synagogue was built in the Orthodox fashion that the bima was in the center. The ark was slightly elevated and was attended by the Kohanim. And the rabbi sat on the right-hand side, and those who were on the elders on the committee sat close to him. So the hierarchy, whoever was closer to the rabbi and the ark, that was quite important within the town. And those who donated most money towards the community life, sat next to the rabbi, my father, because he found himself amongst the better off in the community, and because he was also on the rabbinic council and the town council, he sat fairly close to the rabbi. And that meant for me that I had to sit next to my father and my grandfather from my mother's side and not fidget, because I was sitting there in a prominent position. But sitting there and facing the gallery, I had a very good view of the ladies up on top and my mother, and they had lovely veils. They looked like Goya's painting of Spanish ladies. And I think that this sort of dresses percolated, although they were Ashkenazis, from the Sephardic community from Spain. And to dress up and then to veil yourself and to sit in the balcony was quite a thing. And everybody attended Shabbat service. On Friday night, the women were excused because they prepared the meal so that when the men came from prayer on Friday night, they were there to serve on them. But on Saturday, everybody attended Saturday service. And during the reading of the Torah, we children were allowed to go out and have a little bit of fresh air. For protection, the synagogue was built within a sort of outer compound wall around it, because the anti-Semitism existed in Poland simply because the teaching of the Catholic Church was so bad. And in simple terms, what happened was that Jewish children, after all, we're all Poles, were accused, especially Easter and Christmas, of crucifying Christ. So after Easter, I was a Christ killer, and my grandfather had to teach me how, when I come out from the class, from the Shkoap of Shechna, I take my belt off and I stood how to stand against the wall and swing the belt from side to side so that other children should not beat me up. And then if there was a sort of opening, to run quickly. One was thrown stones at and various other parts. And that was a great pity, because I live now in a very tolerant country where we are either British or English, but we enjoy the same dignity towards one another. Dignity, well, equality in dignity, really. The teachers, too, were, some of them were anti-Semitic, and one suffered. My woman teacher, Mrs. Wisniewska, who was a friend of my mother, was a charming lady, and I was fortunate to be going to the class one at the age of 6, not 7, and have her as my teacher, because she was warm-hearted and tolerant and wise. But her husband was such a brute, and he was also a teacher. He taught math, and he taught gym, but instead of gym, we then had to march in a single file. And because I was tallest in the class, he used to shout into my ear, equivalent to, "Turn left." And by the time it came to left or right, I didn't know which way I was going. So I when she shouted left, I turned right. I was so confused because of this turn, this loud scream into my ear. And I used to march off all by myself, and then he would pull me back by my ear, which was very painful. And in the class, when he told us math, he would walk behind us with a thin rubber truncheon. And if he saw that you made a mistake, he would hit you on the back unexpectedly. And one trembled when one felt that he was behind you, because you felt any moment now you are going to be hit on the back. And there was no redress for that, because the teachers had the power to call the families in. Not that they were summoned to the school and they had to come, and they were told by the teachers, "Your son can't do his sums, and you better take him in hand, and things like that. It was quite interesting that within the hierarchy of the important people in this little town, which was sort of like a large village, first came the chief of police. Then came the judge who lived there, the postmaster, the head chemist. The clergy was absolutely on, very much on top, their own Catholic priest. And these people at the very top were the lawmakers. And we children were taught right from the first day that at school that when we see them in the street, we must raise our caps. So one clicked one's heel together, and there was Mr. Krakowski, the lawyer. One said, "Good morning, Mr. Krakowski." And Catholic children, when they saw the priest, they knelt, not only bowed. And he would go by and pat their heads and walk on. They crossed themselves and knelt, And we Jewish children had to make certain that we spot them and raise our cap and bow. Otherwise, there was punishment at school. And the punishment was also sorted out in various forms. You stood in a corner, or you knelt on grains of rice. It was quite severe, and there was no question of misbehaving. Somebody reported that somebody misbehaved in the town. So-and-so had a catapult and shot off from telegraph pole these ceramic glasses. He was severely punished at school. The school was responsible for him, not only the parents. Coming back to the life in the cheder where Jewish children were taught, the teaching was a form of ritual teaching. We had to pass from grade to grade fairly quickly. And my mother's father, my grandfather, who was my best friend, because he was manager of an estate, agricultural estate, and they lived close to Kowo. And one day the owner, the Poles, who was Roman Catholic, a landowning man, gambled their estate away in a game of cards. And from one day to another, my grandfather was dismissed. And he and grandmother came to live with us. And it was very hard for him. From being a very active man, he suddenly was retired. And my mother's father and mother had three girls. My mother was one, and one son. And the son was a very gifted Talmudist. As a young man, he would go from town to town in order to preach in synagogue and answer various questions on Torah and Talmud. And his desire was really to go to Palestine. And when I was 1 year old, he married, and married through a shatchen, that is a matchmaker, somebody who was fairly well off. And both of them emigrated to Palestine, and he settled in Jerusalem. And life wasn't easy in Jerusalem then. It was terribly hard in the late 20s. And letters came from them. But he requested that he takes grandfather and grandmother to Palestine. And I was very sorry when these letters came. My mother used to tell me that when it was explained to me when I was not quite three that they would be going, I wept. So first my grandmother went. And then there was this terrible crash, depression. And so my grandfather never went. He remained with us. So he and I were very close friends. We had on one side of where the timber was stored a little orchard and pear trees. And I used to climb in the 30s when I was 5, 6. up and shake the branches, and he would collect the pears, and then would sit there and he would tell me stories. We would sit together under the tree, and he would tell me stories. The stories were simply biblical. Sometimes he would also tell me the stories of the state that he was running. And he would tell me stories about my mother and her sister, that my grandfather gave them a lovely horse, which was very fast, and they had a two-wheeler, and it was like a trotter, that horse. And he said, your mother was so spirited that she used to hold the reins, and when the train went by, she would race the train, and the train would slow down in order to not to defeat her. And I always dreamt that one day I'll have a trotter and I'll race the train, and my imagination absolutely ran wild. And I always liked to hear either the biblical embroidered story or the story of my father's estate time, my grandfather's estate time. It was not easy for my grandfather, because in a hierarchy of family where I was the seventh, the youngest, when it came to high holidays and the head of the family performs the prayers before the food, my grandfather had the pride in him that he also wanted to be head of family. So he had a little separate table, and he said the prayers, my father said the prayers, and a sort of working arrangement was worked out where both of them were head of families, and yet the whole system worked. So during one holiday, Passover, the youngest one asked the questions, why were we slaves? And so I used to first ask my grandfather and then come over to my father's, to our table, and ask my father. And so I had a glass of wine with my grandfather and a glass of wine with my family. Well, for a child, that meant quite a lot, and I looked forward to it. Holidays were wonderful because the whole family got together, and it was celebrated in a proper manner, which went on for hundreds of years. Our Passover was very close to Easter, and what marred the Passover was that during Easter and the preaching against the Jews meant that our shutters had to be closed, and when people came out from the church, the Roman Catholic, they would break the windows of Jewish houses.
Did you know these people who did that?
One knew them, and some of them were from villages, and they were so inflamed by the priests. Then, fortunately, the priest changed, and when Piłsudski died, we had a rotten Polish government that was anti-Semitic, but the priest was wonderful, and he became quite friendly with my family. So things really for the Jewish people improved, and there were no more breakages of houses, of beating up people, of turning over stalls in the marketplace, which were Jewish stalls. The priest had a calming influence, and he also had an influence over the chief of police, who was a bit corrupted, and he acted strongly against those who committed certain things, providing he was bribed. And he imitated Piłsudski by having the same sort of moustache like Lech Wałęsa has, and he was a tall, big man. I don't think he was very clever, endowed with enormous brain, but this priest in the middle 30s had a great influence over him and a calming influence over the whole Polish Christian community.